Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom.
Welcome it's to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and part of the Christians for Liberty Network. I am your host, Doug Stewart, and joined with me, as you could see, if you're watching on YouTube, by the way, you need to watch on YouTube because we do video now. So go over and watch on YouTube, pause your player, go watch on YouTube. You're going to see Cody Cook and Alex Bernardo. Both are participants in the Christians for Liberty Network in various ways. Cody has been resurrecting the Faith Seeking Freedom podcast, and Alex Bernardo is, of course, the host of the Protestant Libertarian podcast, and he is always interviewing scholars and controversial figures. And in fact, we're actually having a conversation today about two, I wouldn't say they're two, well, one's controversial, the other talking about controversy, two different individuals that he recently had on his show that represent in many ways two different sort of factions or sides or elements of the libertarian movement or the Libertarian Party and, you know, the direction that it's heading. There's a lot of talk, you know, this year about what's going on. It's been quite a ride for the last 2 years with the Mises Caucus takeover in 2022. And so Alex wanted to have two guys on, and he didn't have them on together. He had them on as two separate episodes, and I'll let Alex explain. But basically what we're going to do is we're going to have a conversation about the who's a true libertarian. I'm pretty sure it's none of us or either only us. I don't know, but we'll figure it out by the end of the episode. Alex, Cody, thanks for joining me.
Good to be here.
It's okay to be here.
Well, this is getting off to a great start.
Yes,
Alex, why don't you sum up your conversations with, it was Zach Weissmuller and Jeremy Kaufman. Start off though with, why do you want to have them on?
Okay, so I discovered that I was a libertarian 8 years ago. And then about 3.5 years ago, I discovered that there were actually different types of libertarians. And I had no idea that there was so much factionalism within the libertarian movement. But it became apparent to me when I began reading Murray Rothbard's work at the, as like in the summer of 2021, that the libertarian movement really could kind of be divided up into like a left and right sphere. And there are different ways of looking at that. But it was pretty obvious to me that Reason Magazine, and then I think even further to the side, Cato represents one way of thinking about libertarianism, whereas like the Mises Institute and kind of the Rothbardian tradition represent a second way of looking at that. And over the last couple of months, there have been a couple of articles posted at Reason Magazine that were very critical of the Mises Caucus, which is the caucus that is, I guess, technically in control of the Libertarian Party right now, which is certainly right-leaning libertarian-oriented. And there was a very popular article that was published by Liz Wolf, who hosts the podcast for Reason and writes for Reason Magazine, and her co-host is Zach Weissmuller, where she was critical of the Mises Caucus leadership and kind of critical of the future of the party. That was an article that really triggered kind of a hostile response to people that are on the other side of that libertarian divide. The Mises Caucus type people and the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire in particular was very vocal online about their disdain for that article. And so Zach Weissmuller was online defending it, and Jeremy Kaufman was online criticizing it. And so I just opened up to both of them that I'd be happy to have both of them on my show to talk it through. And so I was able to get Zach on and kind of interview him about everything, what he thought about the left-right libertarian split, what he thought about the article, what he thought about the Mises Caucus and the direction of the party, and I had Jeremy Kaufman on to do the exact same thing. They gave two very different perspectives on liberty. And it was really great just to kind of see how both of them thought about the libertarian movement and the possibility for the future growth of that movement. And I thought it was a really helpful conversation. I mean, to put my cards on the table, I know that the three of us have talked about this outside of the podcast before, but I do align myself with the Mises Caucus, and I consider myself to be, I guess, a right-leaning libertarian, if that distinction really makes sense. But I don't hate Reason Magazine. There's actually a lot of things that I like about Reason Magazine, and I think that they're all great libertarians, and there are a lot of people that are like in the left libertarian camp that I have a lot of respect for. So I really want to hear both sides of the issue and just give everyone a fair opportunity to express their position. So that was kind of the entire back and forth, and the episodes have been doing really well, and it was really cool to have the experience of talking to both of those guys.
Was there any reason why you didn't consider
a quick question? I can jump in.
Can I just have a follow-up?
Is there actually a big divide, or has that kind of been exaggerated? So, like, I listened to both episodes, and I noticed that, like, you know, Kaufman had mentioned that the Libertarian News commentary site Reason, he was arguing that they were sort of left libertarian. He highlighted their voting disclosures, which they do every election. And he claimed that in the last presidential election, Reason Magazine staff voted for Biden 6-1, which was both incorrect and misleading. And so, because the actual breakdown was, I think three said they were going to vote for Biden. One was like a maybe. It was 1 for Trump, 10 for Jorgensen, the libertarian candidate, and then 7 said they're not voting. So that you know, Biden portion is pretty small. Trump was smaller. And I also suspect that if you went back to kind of a pre-Trump election, what you'd sort of find is that they'd probably swing a little bit more conservative, which was basically true. If you go back to 2012, it was 0 voted for Obama, 1 was a probable Romney vote, and then 20 for Johnson, then 7 not voting. Gary Johnson, libertarian candidate. So there was that. So like I felt like he was sort of exaggerating that divide. I think to some extent the Mises caucus has been kind of too broadly and maybe unfairly painted as racists by the anti-Mises camp.
Yeah.
There's a little something to that critique that I think we could get into, but largely it's been overstated.
Yeah.
And so like I guess my question is there actually a divide, and what does it look like? So for you, Alex, you're sort of saying you acknowledge this, you noticed it, you felt like you were on one side of it. So is there a divide? And if it is it political? Is it stylistic? Is it strategic? Or is it like a culture war thing? What does that look like?
I think it's a little bit of all of them. And I'd love to get your perspective on this in just a minute. Now, I started reading Hans Hermann Hoppe about a month ago. Tho Bishop on Twitter recommended a couple of articles, and then I bought some of his books. So I read one and I'm halfway through a second one. And he really is kind of like the heir of Murray Rothbard. And in his analysis of the difference between left and right libertarianism, it's all about egalitarian rhetoric. And so his split would be that on the right, you have the kind of libertarianism that acknowledges that there are natural differences among people and that celebrate those differences and that believe that people should be able to group based on those differences. Whereas left-leaning libertarians, they might believe that philosophically, but their language and their rhetoric is more directed towards egalitarian ends. I think that that's a big part of it. I also think that a lot of it has to do with, and this is something that I think both Zach and Jeremy acknowledge when I talk to them, is that left libertarianism tends to represent libertarian philosophy with ideas and policies and concepts that are popular to those that are on the left, mm-hmm. whereas right-leaning libertarians, they tend to gear their analysis of libertarianism towards issues that are popular for people on the right. And so for me, when I first became a libertarian in 2016, you know, growing up in Kentucky, I've always kind of had I'm a very traditional Christian in terms of social practice. I've always had kind of a conservative bent to me. And I remember reading Reason Magazine, and I was like, I agree with everything they say philosophically, but like a lot of the issues they cover make me kind of uncomfortable as someone who's more conservative. And it wasn't until I found like the Mises Rothbard wing of the party, the Tom Woods, those kind of people, where I was like, okay, this is a little bit more in line with my kind of more conservative personal values. And so I also do think, like, strategically, if you take the egalitarianism issue and you take that we're going to appeal to right-leaning issues and left-leaning issues into the equation, then obviously that's going to affect your strategy from a political perspective. And so I think that's where a lot of the divergence between the two parties go. Philosophically, I think that we agree on almost everything, but a lot of it has to do with the details, the messaging, and the direction that we think that this movement should head. I don't know if you guys feel like that's a fair characteristic or a fair characterization, but...
Yeah.
So I do have some thoughts about where these divides might be, but I do want to ask one clarification question, because it sounded to me like you were saying that the right libertarians sort of say, well, there's differences among people groups and that we should want to self-separate and that's okay. So that sounds like racial separation to me. So am I missing something, or is that what I'm hearing?
Well, no, I mean, it's not necessarily that it has to be racial separation. And in reading Hoppe, I understand how people that are not used to thinking about the issue of association in the way that like right-leaning people would might misconstrue some of his language as racist. But I think essentially what he's saying is that there is an argument to be made that people that, and it is like, you know, there, I guess there are people that could take this to like racial extremes, but people are different and people tend to gravitate towards those that are similar to them. And we should just be aware that that's a reality and not necessarily say that from the outset, that is a bad thing. Not you necessarily have to exclude certain people, but it is helpful to live in a culture where there are people that share broadly your cultural values. I don't even think it comes down to race so much as it comes down to kind of intellectual, cultural, and moral values. And that's really where that dividing line would occur.
So
go ahead.
No, it's fine. I just wanted to ask one of the things that I kind of noticed in that critique of a right-leaning libertarian, you know, the Rothbardian critique. I mean, I've noticed this over the last, you know, 20 years in becoming a libertarian, that those on the little bit more classical liberal / left end of the spectrum, if we want to use that spectrum, you know, left and right,
And I've always failed to understand why they feel like it is racist. And the best I can come up with is their arguments appeal to those who are a lot more in line with conservative racism justification. Hey, we just want to be with people who are like us, which, you know, on the one hand is understandable. On the other hand, maybe there's more to what it means to actually, you know, live in a society than just like huddling with, you know, people who are like you, which can be coded language for, you know, we just want to be with our own white people, right? And maybe there are actual racists in that regard or in that faction or whatever. But it seems to me that it's more like, hey, what you're saying appeals to people who are not race conscious or whatever you want to say about that, who have not evolved beyond, you know, being colorblind. Or evolved to being colorblind, I should say. And that doesn't seem to me to be a very compelling argument for saying, well, they're racist, right? Like, it's just a matter of like, well, your argument appeals to that. And it's similar to like the left, like the woke left, not the left of libertarianism, but the woke left saying, well, if we get to something like federalism and states' rights, then we're just going to end up with Jim Crow again because some states are just simply racist and that's going to appeal to, and it's going to sort of enable that to happen. So it's like the enabling attitude of their arguments that people are typically concerned with.
So are we talking about sort of ethno-nationalism in a way, Alex, or are we talking about something else when you talk about people sort of separating in different ways? Or is that just one way that people might separate and that's legitimate? Or I get how central is that to what we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's that central. I do think that on the one hand, the idea that people of a certain racial background could, in a libertarian society, self-segregate as long as they're not violating the natural rights of other people and right. They self-segregate using private property, that's not necessarily out of bounds within a libertarian. So it's not inconsistent with libertarian principles. I think that the problem that like the Mises Caucus and other right-leaning libertarians have with the entire racial conversation is that they look at the way that racist has been used as a term to promote mm-hmm. a progressive policy agenda, and they just reject that outright. And so they're not afraid of having those kind of conversations and being labeled a racist because they understand that there's nothing inherently valuable behind that category. So it's a rejection of the terms that the left use.
Yeah.
And really, I think that's a lot of what this comes down to, is that when I look at Reason Magazine, I think that in general, they're more comfortable operating within the rhetorical boundaries that have been established by the progressive left. I think there's a really important place for that within libertarianism. But when you look at like the Mises Institute and that wing of the Libertarian Party, they feel like those boundaries are arbitrary and we don't have to confine our conversations to those boundaries, if that makes sense.
If I could push back, I mean, Reason has welcomed John McWhorter, Coleman Hughes, Camille Foster. And it seems to me that they are pushing back on the progressive kind of what passes for anti-racism, but they're doing it through a lens of colorblindness and individualism. And it seems like the libertarian right is saying, oh no, actually we should sort of self-segregate by groups. Let's not be colorblind. It's actually sort of okay to do this. And I feel like that's the wrong response. I feel like they've overshot the actual libertarian, the philosophical libertarian answer to this problem, which is colorblindness and individuality. Now, of course, if racists want to live together, they have the right to do that. But should we sort of see like, I don't know, a faction of libertarianism that says we're sort of rooted in the idea of separation, well, that's just not really my kind of libertarianism, I guess. I just don't feel like on the one hand, sure, like it's also like you can, you know, overdose on heroin if you want to too. Like you're allowed to do that, but is that like a smart thing to do? Like is that consistent with like self-interest and so I have some concerns about that.
Like it seems to me that there's a lot of this is about how do we appeal to others who are not libertarian?
Yeah,
as opposed to how do we, and I think they're linked probably more than we might want to say. I don't want to write it off and say, oh, well, this is just an evangelistic, you know, tactic that the left is using versus the right is using. I think it's more rooted in how do we actually reach other people is rooted also in the philosophy itself. Because they're not not that separatable. Oh, terrible word, terrible sentence structure there. But anyway,
yeah,
I think it's more to it than that, than just evangelistic. But I mean, what element of this is about the appeal versus the underlying philosophy?
I mean, I definitely think that's there. Cody, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the divide could be sort of evangelistic. It could also be sort of about what the sides are willing to compromise on. Because it seems to me like, you know, open borders is a pretty traditional libertarian position, but the libertarian right has kind of moved away from that, right? And we sort of compromised more with the right on that position. I've said before that, so like we talked about like sort of Reason versus like Mises Institute or whatever. Yeah. There's also like the Mises Caucus, which is part of the Libertarian Party, a certain sort of group within there. And the Classical Liberal Caucus are kind of their foil, more or less. And I've sort of said before that the Classical Liberal Caucus are libertarians except when they're Democrats, and the Mises Caucus are libertarians except when they're MAGA. And it may be a little more nuanced than that, especially in light of, I think, what Arnold Kling has noted, that there's just been a recalibration that Trump has brought to American politics away from a right-wing emphasis on order and institutions and toward a right-wing hatred for cosmopolitan elites and the establishment. And because Reason sort of feels establishment and sort of feels elite, there's sort of a negative opinion about that. I think the Mises side is ultimately trying to win over the populist right that has coalesced around Trump. So there is a strategy here. They're very careful to avoid anything that sounds woke or smacks of sympathy for the establishment.
Mm-hmm.
I think one big criticism that the Mises crowd had of Reason was that they were favorable and optimistic to the COVID vaccines early on, and that that supposedly proved that they were establishment controlled opposition, which is why it was really funny to me, Alex, when Jeremy Kaufman, due to his scientific background, when he was on your show, he had to acknowledge some positive things about the COVID vaccines. The Mises like sort of side, their controversial tweets look like mocking John McCain's daughter for mourning at her dad's funeral, sharing memes of puppet masters with big noses and little curls hanging over their sideburns, if you know what I mean. And in contrast, the Classical Liberal Caucus, the Reason, the Cato, we'll just kind of haphazardly lump them all together. They're more concerned, I think, about like respectability, sort of more mild-mannered analysis. I think they're far more cosmopolitan than populist, and I think they're more likely to err on the side of sounding too progressive. So like their controversial tweets would be like Joe Jorgensen saying we should be actively anti-racist and Chase Oliver saying that all labor has value. The fact that there are people who get more bent out of shape by someone using the now politically charged word anti-racist haphazardly than they do about their, you know, party promoting anti-Semitic conspiracy theories boggles my mind a little bit. It seems to me there is this kind of big tent that we're all in, but like if I'm wanting to lean a certain direction, I'm probably going to lean away from the racism. Like I feel pretty good about. That's kind of where I feel comfortable.
Yeah, I really do think that you, like, you know, I think, Doug, you hit the nail on the head when you, and you too, Cody, you kind of referenced this before, when you really talked about how populism is kind of a big distinguishing factor between the Mises wing of the party and kind of the Reason wing of the party, or we'll just call them left and right libertarianism from here on out. I really do think that right-wing libertarianism leans very heavily into populism. That appeals to people like me. I love the populist tendencies on the libertarian right. And I talked about this with both Jeremy and Zach. And this is where I think that these strategies are not necessarily mutually incompatible. I think that there is a place for an institution like Reason Magazine to operate within the framework of the reigning paradigm, try to reach out to the elites, try to deal with issues that are kind of really at the pulse and the center of American culture. There's a place for that. But I also think the populist element of there are these elites out there that really are kind of pulling the strings behind everything that's happening in society, and they're screwing all of us over. We need that message desperately. And that's why, like, when I look at the messaging coming out of the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire, now as like a Christian, I wouldn't post that on my social media page, but with the Meghan McCain tweet where it was Meghan McCain crying over the grave of her father, and they posted on the anniversary of John McCain's death. I'm not in principle against that kind of messaging, because I think that what it reveals and what it's designed to reveal is that there are more Americans that are upset by how untasteful or distasteful that post is, but they're not pissed off that John McCain supported all these policies that literally led to the deaths of millions of people in the Middle East, which is the thing that we should really be mad about. And so I think that the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire does a great job of exposing just how hypocritical many Americans' political analysis is.
Yeah.
Really, really, really are. I mean, they're very shallow and facile, and there is just a failure to get to the heart of the issues that really matter. And like to me, I don't have any sympathy for people like crying over a war criminal if they're not going to cry over the millions of people that were murdered because of their policies. If that makes sense. Now, again, is that
what did Zach say to that? I mean, I think you talked about that with him. Like, what did he? How did he find that strategy? Like, that is in theory a good strategy. He probably disagreed, right?
Yeah. Well, and the same thing. He thought that it wasn't tasteful and that it was going to push more people away than it helped. Of course, like Jeremy's response to that is that he doesn't believe that the vast majority of Americans are ever going to convert to libertarian philosophy, because it takes really a certain kind of like mental set and a certain kind of personality set. Maybe not biologically innate. Like, people can be convinced of these ideas, but because most people want to operate within the mainstream, they're never going to accept this kind of messaging. And so you should just go ahead and be radical and try to get as many people as you can that way.
So it's, again, two fundamentally different approaches to messaging. I think both of them have their place and can be utilized effectively in different contexts.
Yeah, I mean, we've all talked here about how, like, there are, and I think you and Alex, you and I have talked about this, where there are people who, if we're trying to convince them, we might send them a Reason article, or we might send them a Mises.org mm-hmm. article, or we might send them an article from libertarianchristians.com if it's, you know, if it's a Christian wanting a particularly Christian argument. If Jeremy thinks that nobody is going to be mainstream because libertarianism is just going to be this fringe viewpoint, at least for the foreseeable future, I don't know if adding more fringe people to the movement is going to be more attractive in the direction of it might become mainstream one day. Whereas if you were going to take a more non-fringe approach, it's possible that people are going to see Reason as a journalistic outfit as more, as respectable, because they aren't peddling what feels like not quite news, but only, you know, sort of news and commentary all mixed in. I know that there's that still happens at Reason. I mean, it happens everywhere, but it's very clear when you read, like, I was reading like the Huffington Post. We're recording this in the like longest year of a week that we just we just had. I mean, we've just gotten proof of life that Biden really is still alive after resigning for the run. So this is the week we're recording that, just so people understand. And, you know, reading the news is just like ridiculously biased no matter where you are. And so when you read someone like on more on the right wing, it does kind of have that little sense of conspiracy theory going on. That's not how Reason is going to tackle, you know, topics. And so they will look respectable in news circles, in more elite circles, and become more respectable. And they've pushed actual agendas by their coverage and have actually, you know, I think in some ways moved the needle. Now, they just chalk it up to libertarianism moving the needle toward drug legalization and some other, you know, wins on free speech and things like that. But I would say that being respectable to the elites is probably more eschewed by those on the right anyway.
Yeah.
And so they don't want to be respectable to the elites. And so it's kind of a self-defeating kind of situation. Whereas I think that if they opened up their minds a little bit, they can reach people with better rhetoric while also being as trollish and bombastic in a sort of tactical way. Michael Malice does a really good job of this. He's very strategic in how he, you know, handles, you know, critique, or how he critiques things on Twitter. He probably would have had a better tweet over Meghan McCain's crying over John McCain at John McCain's funeral than Jeremy Coffin would. And it would have been more tasteful and probably more attractive.
Well, in point of fact, he's befriended Meghan McCain and he's sort of shifted her a little bit more toward the libertarian position because he didn't mock her for crying at her dad's funeral.
Yeah, Jeremy Coffin will probably never get that opportunity.
Probably not. No, and I don't know that I buy that the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire was really playing, you know, 4D chess with that tweet. I think that they were just being douches. And then like people responded and they were like, well, and then I think some other people sort of jumped in and said, well, if you care so much about Meghan McCain's feelings, why don't you care about the people that, you know, John McCain? Sure, fine, fair enough. But it's not like everybody who found that tweet objectionable was like a war hawk, right? I mean,
for sure.
You can find war disgusting. And also think it's like just totally.
Well, I think embarrassing is sometimes the word that people use for the New Hampshire, right. Like for the New Hampshire Twitter account. Right? Or the LPNH. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's more like it's embarrassing and it's a little bit more of what does this make us look like? And so you read that. And this is, again, this is sort of like the Southern Poverty Law Center's sort of tactic is to sort of like pick the worst of what is out there in libertarian world. And they'd say, this is what is represented.
Broke.
Well, it'd be, I mean, obviously you can't get rid of all the losers out there, but you have to realize that you are going to get played this way and it's going to have some sort of reputational repercussions for the movement.
Yeah, but there's never been though, like, and maybe this is because I'm a horrible person and people are going to judge me as a Christian because of this, but there's never been a tweet that LPNH has sent out that has not like made me chuckle a little bit. Even the ones that I'm like, whoa,
that is
really out there on the edge. Like I always get a good laugh out of it, but that's because I have that kind of a sense of humor. But I really do kind of just to push back a little bit on that, Cody, mm-hmm. I really do feel like of all of the state affiliates, I feel like the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire has been consistently anti-war and anti-Federal Reserve for a very long time. And I know, even talking to Jeremy, he acknowledged when he was on my show that they try to be provocative when they put tweets out
that are like that. And he said that he doesn't all, they don't always get it right. Sometimes they go too far. Sometimes they don't hit exactly the way that they wanted to. But I know in particular with the Meghan McCain tweet that that really was designed to be kind of like, all right, this guy's a war hawk. We really should be mocking him, which again, as a Christian, that would not be my approach. But I don't necessarily think that it is always strategically off the table. And that will appeal to a certain segment of the American population. Now, again, well, you know, I don't know. I know Doug made the point. Is that really the kind of population they want in there? But it does appeal to a certain group of people.
You know, there's a strategy. I mean, and it's sort of the Trump strategy. But I think the concern, you know, people talk about Trump derangement syndrome as if it's just a thing on the left. But there, I mean, Trump has sort of deranged everybody.
Yes, I totally agree.
And I feel like what sort of happened with, you know, the Trump strategy is to sort of, I think, try to make people hate each other a little bit. And I sort of feel like we do have to live together, you know, the idea of a civil divorce notwithstanding. And so like, I do think that it's important that we sort of are trying to move things in the right direction. But as far as strategy is concerned, like, I mean, I think the Mises crowd has a concern for what I've called respectability politics in reverse. They don't really care if they sound like racist or nationalist or whatever. They just don't want to sound woke. And like, yeah. And it's like sort of an obsession that I think is almost a little bit silly.
Yeah,
and there is some like history here that I think we need to like think about a little bit, which is like within the libertarian movement, like the paleo strategy where libertarians were trying to build a coalition with Pat Buchanan conservatives. And I think ultimately we were captured by them more than we changed them. And, you know, some of the stuff that Lou Rockwell was ghostwriting in the Ron Paul report was pretty yikes about the criminality and welfare mindset of the blacks, for instance. And, you know, there's a concern, I think, that libertarians could be captured by the left as well. And that's a totally legitimate concern. But if the libertarian right were sort of leaning in the direction of like Jonah Goldberg or David French, minus the war hawk stuff, I don't think I'd mind that so much, because I feel like there is a respectability to the conservative tradition and a legitimacy to it. But if we're just talking about kind of, you know, I'm concerned that there's a real danger of right-wing capture. And it's from not like the sort of traditional conservative tradition, but like alt-right, anti-intellectual, populist bigotry and Trumpism. And that makes me concerned. So I don't know. You know, I have friends who are kind of more on the libertarian right who were just like incensed that Chase Oliver tweeted that all labor has value. And, you know, they read into that two different things. One thing they read was like the labor theory of value, which obviously I don't think that's what he believes. You know, because libertarians would argue that labor doesn't have value inherently. It's, you know, it's sort of what people are willing to pay for it. I think what they were sort of right about, though, is he was sort of trying to make a sort of progressive point, I guess, which is, and also in a way, it's really a populist point if you think about it, that, you know, the work that you do has value. It has value perhaps to God. It has value to yourself. It has value to your community. Just because you're not, you know, Jeff Bezos or whatever doesn't mean your work doesn't have value. You should value the work that you do. And like that, like just sets those people off. But like, you know, some of the unhinged or potentially racist or anti-Semitic stuff is just like, no, they got that wrong. And and so I worry that Mises caucus, that Mises caucus wing of libertarianism are making a huge miscalculation. I think they see an alt-right populist hatred for the establishment, and they assume that it's libertarian adjacent, when I think it's mostly just sort of unarticulated rage and a desire for revenge because people are unhappy with their lives. And I think you could harness that to some extent, but it requires a careful, cultivated conversion of the alt-right, not a coalition between libertarians and the alt-right. Because I don't think statism, tribalism, collectivism can be reconciled with libertarianism.
Yeah, well, it is interesting because Hans Hermann Hoppe had a book that was published maybe in 2019. I don't know. It was the first full book that I read called Getting Libertarianism Right. Mm. And he talks about the relationship that libertarians need to have with certain groups on the right. And he's very critical of many figures in the alt-right for doing exactly what you just said. So that I think there is a space even within that tradition for delineating, hey, we have our libertarian principles and we have to make sure that we are consistent in maintaining them. I do want to ask you, Cody, this question, because I feel like especially with the members of the Mises caucus that are very much against the Chase Oliver campaign. And this is going to be, I guess, hopefully no one judges me for this, but I'll put my cards on the table here too. I don't really have that much of a problem with Chase Oliver. I mean, I think that he definitely has some positions that I don't agree with, but he like,
I agree with 98% of what he believes. Like, I think he's a good libertarian, and I think that that's really valuable, and I'm probably going to wind up voting for him. I understand, like, if you're not living, you know, I live in a red state, Trump's going to get our 8 votes, doesn't matter, whatever. In a swing state, maybe it's different. But I think that a lot of the response to the Chase Oliver campaign and the Mises caucus in general has been from the equally negative and vicious response that the classical liberal caucus type people had towards the Mises caucus. I mean, I follow a lot of the classical liberal caucus type people on Twitter, and they're just as mean and hateful towards the Mises caucus people as the Mises caucus people can be to them. So would you see that maybe it's just an like that the maybe unproductive and sometimes overly hostile nature of the conversation is a product of people that are on both sides of the political divide?
Yes, there's good and bad people on both sides.
Yeah,
that I can tell you.
Yeah,
I was just in Charlottesville a few weeks ago, and I can hear the echoes of that statement still. Just walking, walking down the streets of Charlottesville.
No, and you know what? I'm not on the classical liberal caucus because I do think that they to me, being a libertarian means not having to compromise. If I wanted to compromise, I'd be a Republican or a Democrat. Yeah. And so, you know, I don't think we should compromise our core values. I find the Mises stuff to be kind of grosser sometimes, but ultimately, like, I'm not on that side. Mm-hmm. I think some of that stuff is unfair. And ultimately, I think that they also compromise in the other direction. I mean, as for like Chase Oliver, I don't think that there should be libertarians who are more comfortable with Trump than Chase Oliver. And, you know, my thing with Chase Oliver, I remember seeing, you know, in the last year, a couple events he was at, there was kind of this weird sort of third party debate thing and a speech he made here and there. And I liked him, and I thought he was a good communicator for libertarianism. The two big issues, he's pro-choice and I'm not. If I thought he had a chance of winning, I probably wouldn't vote for him because of that. Well, but because he does, yeah. And I'm happy to just do a signal vote. The other thing is his kind of moderate position on transing the kids, they say.
Yeah, that's a bad one.
Which I don't love. But that being said, it's still within the realm of libertarian discussion. Like, what are your rights as a kid? What are your rights as a parent?
Right.
How should the state get involved? Because ultimately the side on the right is saying we should have the state more involved in these things.
Well,
which you could argue is a less libertarian position.
Well, just to go to bat just for a little bit for Chase on that particular issue is his goal, and he's been asked about this on Reason did a really good Just Asking Questions episode,
yeah.
Where they grilled him on this pretty hard actually, because it's a big deal. And so you'd think if it was, you know, the left libertarian group would not do that, but they did. Okay, so just want to point that out for the first thing. But the thing was, is he was just trying to be like, look, the big question here is what part of the government should be part of our medical decisions, and that is zero. And so that was how it was a libertarian answer, and how he was, attempting to shift the Overton window of acceptable opinion to be like, oh, well, yeah, no, we shouldn't be let the government, you know, dictate that. It is between, a woman or parents and their doctor and the kid and all, whatever he said there.
But he does something similar that pro-choicers do there, though, right? Whereas he sort of argues that in some circumstances.
It's a very Bill Clinton answer. No, I get that.
Because ultimately, like, his position is puberty blockers, fine, but not hormones and not surgery, right? More or less.
I don't want to speak for him because I don't quite remember, but that sounds about right.
That was what I recall from the Reason interview.
Yeah, what I remember, yeah.
So he's taking kind of a moderate position. He's like, okay, well, maybe puberty blockers aren't so bad. I mean, there's evidence that they could have long-term negative effects, but
yeah.
But he's trying to sort of, I think, you know, he lives in this world where the trans thing is legitimate, but also maybe over the top and exaggerated in sort of a cultural contagion. So he's trying to, I think, put himself in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And he does sort of something similar that like pro-choicers do, where it's like, oh, it's always a woman's decision. Well, unless you're in the last trimester or something like that. Now it's not anymore.
Yeah.
So there is an inconsistency.
Well, I want to make a comment about the whole signaling thing. Like you said a few minutes ago that something about appealing to Trump versus appealing to Chase Oliver, right? And like he shouldn't be any. How did you say it? You don't think he should be?
I think it's there shouldn't be libertarians who are more comfortable with Donald Trump than Chase Oliver.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the thing. I heard you say that and I'm thinking, okay, but that's because, and it kind of gives away the game, right? They know Chase Oliver is not going to be the next president. I mean, I don't know. This week has been so crazy weird. So maybe it could be Chase Oliver versus RFK Jr. is the only two candidates left by the end of the month. I realize that a disaster would have had to happen to something. So I don't really wish that on anybody. But yeah, in terms of, you know, if we were writing a script, that would be cool. But it kind of gives it away. It's like, well, my vote is just a signal vote. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. I don't want to say that there's nothing wrong with virtue signaling, because there is a sense in which it is a protest vote. And I want to protest against Donald Trump. I want to protest against whomever, right? Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, whatever it might be. Whoever it might be. But I got to vote for Trump because Joe Biden or Kamala Harris or the left, right? And so there is a sort of implicit acknowledgement and admission that whatever it is you vote for, whether it's you know, any libertarian candidate that you would have wanted to be as a libertarian candidate, is just a signal vote. Why isn't the logic playing out as, well, I'm just going to pick one of the two parties as well? I'm not here to advocate for voting for anybody for any particular reason. LCI doesn't endorse candidates, or, you know, we don't endorse the Libertarian Party. Obviously, we're here having an argument about the Libertarian Party and how possibly ineffective it is in certain ways. And we're critiquing factions of the party and the movement. And so we're here to, you know, speak the truth and discuss ideas. I don't know. That's one thought. I had another thought that I wanted to bring up, which is the avoidance of, what would you call it? Virtue signaling in the opposite direction, Cody, or something, or respectability.
Reverse
respectability.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me, and it seems like a little bit of a shallow take. Not your take. Sorry, I don't mean that. I just realized that's what I would, how that sentence came out. I think it's a shallow angle to look at what the left is doing and try to be as anti-racist as possible, or as anti-woke as possible, as if that's the only thing that matters. Now, you guys know that you probably have friends who think you're one of those liberals who believe we should legalize drugs. And you also probably have friends, you're one of those conservatives who believes in the free market. We're stuck in the middle. People think we're liberals. Liberals think we're conservatives. Conservatives think we're liberals. We're stuck, right? And so the avoidance of looking like a liberal is dictating the messaging, right? Or I'm suggesting that might be part of why the messaging tends to be avoidant of sounding like woke. And that seems to me to be a little bit short-sighted on the one hand, simply because people are more complex than that. And when you have conversations with people, you can actually get them to realize that you're not liberal or you're not conservative, you're a libertarian, and you have a consistent ethic, or you have a consistent worldview on how politics ought to be, you know, considered. Right. And, you know, we can talk about how, the Democrats and the Republicans are basically two sides of the same coin, and they're more about power and I'm less about power. You know, I want libertarianism to, you know, take over the world, to leave it alone. It seems to me that is a shallow way of looking at how we reach other people. That's what I meant to say was shallow, not you, Cody.
Yeah.
I don't know. Would you guys have any thoughts on that?
Would you mind if I circle back to the first thing about voting for Trump real fast before I answer
yeah.
that question?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, because I really do think that I understand why there are a lot of libertarians that are supporting Donald Trump this cycle and that are supporting RFK. Now, I live in no matter what happens in November, all 8 of Kentucky's electoral votes are going for Donald Trump. My vote does not matter at all. So I can vote for Chase Oliver and support the Libertarian Party and everything's fine. But if I was
vote for yourself, Alex, just for yourself.
Yeah. Well, I get to vote for Thomas Massey. So I can at least, you know, I can at least feel confident in that one. But like, you guys live in swing states. So I understand why people might make the calculation and thinking, okay, I'm going to vote for Donald Trump because realistically Chase Oliver is not going to win. And Donald Trump might get us closer to our goals than a Kamala Harris presidency could. Or I can also understand libertarians voting for an RFK because strategically, and I think that he's kind of getting the Ron Paul treatment in the press right now. I think that his poll numbers are actually probably a little bit higher than what they're leading on. He's got a shot at flipping a state. I really do think that he does. And if he did that, that would change electoral politics forever. So I can understand why there would be libertarians that would get behind Trump and not Chase Oliver if you're in a swing state. I just think a lot of that has to come down to how strategic you want to be with your vote. I mean, ultimately, you know, 130 million people vote. So like, one person's vote doesn't actually matter. It's like my presidential vote does not matter in Kentucky. But I do think that there's kind of that strategic element to it. And then also going back to the messaging thing that you addressed there, Doug, this is why I'm comfortable with what both Reason Magazine and the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire are doing. I think that those messages can appeal to different groups of people, and we need as wide of a net
as possible. And this is where, like, bringing it back to the biblical element. When you look at what the Apostle Paul did in his evangelism, he was able to tailor his message to all of his audiences, which is why each of his letters are a little bit different. He was brilliant at that. He knew how to approach every single audience to which he wrote. And I think that we should be able to embody that in the way that we present libertarianism. I think the perception from people on the left that we're radical conservatives and the perception from people on the right that we're radical liberals is actually really advantageous, because that means that when I'm like, and I do this with my friends, like when I'm in a social situation where I'm surrounded by people that are on the left, then I can kind of play up like the, you know, yeah, we're all about drug legalization and we want to help the poor. And, you know, and that plays really well. Same thing when I'm with people on the right. Yeah, there are these elites out there that are screwing us. These government regulations are harming the economy. So I think that there's a place for both of those elements. Cody, I'm sorry, I threw a lot of stuff at you right there, but I'd love to get your thoughts on all of those things.
Yeah. So on the voting thing, I mean, I think about what Lysander Spooner said a lot, which is, and I'll paraphrase here, that voting for the least painful spanking for you personally is legitimate. And so what I was saying, I think, was more that there are people out there who single out one or two things about a candidate that can't win, but agrees with them on 99% of everything. And they really just focus on that 1%. Like, that's just ridiculous. And that's horrible. And they're like, well, I'll vote for this statist over here who's, you know, who's a protectionist and all this other stuff. And that's like, yeah, I don't really feel guilty about that at all. I guess that's kind of what I was getting at. Yeah, as for the respectability politics in reverse thing, just if I were to kind of bumper sticker this, just kind of make it a slogan, it would be that neither wokeness nor douchebaggery is a legitimate political philosophy. You have to have something a little stronger than either one of those.
Yeah, that's like two bumper stickers, I think.
Yeah. Well, that last sentence you can leave off.
Yeah, sure. No, that's fine.
Neither wokeness nor douchebaggery.
Yeah. No, that's good. All right. I'm going to leave you guys with any last minute thoughts or comments before we wrap up here. Then I want to tell everybody else what LCI is up to and how they can get involved, especially around the topic of voting.
Yeah, I just want to say that I think that it is, just like I believe that it's possible for Christians from different denominations to come together and have thoughtful, respectful conversations without denying them the right to be a participant in the faith. I also think that libertarians from different backgrounds or different perspectives need to learn how to come together and have more productive conversations like the one that we're having right now. And like Zach and Jeremy both being very gracious and coming on my show and talking to me about these issues. We need more of that, because that's actually going to be what promotes our agenda and helps us move forward as libertarians. So we need to have more of this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Good. Hey, a quick question for you, Alex. When right after you gave your summary, I was going to chime in and ask you this question, and I have my mic on mute and I couldn't even talk over Cody because he couldn't hear me. So that's why it looks like I was talking, because I was and you couldn't hear me. Did you consider having Zach and Jeremy on the same episode, or did you even think about that at all?
I had to squeeze it in before Freedom Fest. There was no way I would be able to accommodate it with my schedule. But I in the future, I would be open to having Zach, or if Liz wants to come on and we want to get someone else from LPNH, I'd be happy to have any combination of those people on to have a conversation.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. No, I just wanted. I didn't know if that was even consideration in your mind, or if you thought it would just be better to do two episodes. Of course, having two conversations got you two episodes, and they're both great. Everybody got to say their piece. It was really good. Yeah. I strongly recommend doing that. Cody, what thoughts do you have?
Yeah, I just want to mention real quick, because I don't know if you discussed it much in the main podcast, but the Libertarian Christian Book Club, it's something that Doug has started, and all three of us have hosted or co-hosted one. I'm wrapping up one right now. I mentioned Arnold Kling earlier, his book, The Three Languages of Politics. We're wrapping up as we're recording this. I don't know exactly when this is coming out. There's a gap in August where we're not doing one, but we're going to jump right back into it in September and October. And we'd love to have you guys on. It's been really great sort of camaraderie, good discussion. And, if you're a lonely libertarian, isolated guy, doesn't have a girlfriend, perfect.
Even if you have one.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, well, we're all married and doing perfectly fine in that area. But we'd love to have you. And it's been a really good thing that you started, Doug.
Yeah. So I was going to share my screen, but I don't have the right permission set up because I didn't plan to. But if you go to libertarianchristians.com/events, you'll see the September and October book clubs that are out there. The one in October is on a book called Electing Not to Vote. And there's a handful of essays on different perspectives from Christians on why they should not, why their reasons are for not voting. No, we're not trying to get people to not vote. It's not taking a political stance, but the book club itself is actually has been really great, as Cody's just described. So that's really good. The other thing, if you're listening to this, go over to YouTube and subscribe to our show, because we actually do live streams a lot more frequently than we used to. We used to kind of just do them randomly on big events. We've been doing the presidential debates commentary live during the presidential debates. So you want to subscribe to our YouTube channel because then you'll get an alert when we're actually live, right? The other thing is this, if you're listening to this and you're not watching, you could be watching. And what you'll notice is that Cody has come to the table representing the sort of not quite, I'm a little bit allergic to the right-wing side of the libertarian perspective. But if you were watching, you'd understand the irony in the contrast between Cody and Alex's backgrounds. And so you're missing out on something. We'll just leave that at that. So you can go over to the YouTube channel and chuckle. If you have any sense of where I am and my background is quite socialist right now. So we'll leave it at that. You're missing out if you're not watching.
Alex looks far more like an elitist than me. He looks far more elite than I do, is what I should say.
Please don't do that to me.
All right. Well, hey guys, I really appreciate it. So for everybody, we got three podcast hosts here, basically. So you got a Faith Seeking Freedom podcast that Cody helps us resurrect, the Protestant Libertarian podcast that Alex is part of. And then of course you're listening to this podcast. So go subscribe on YouTube to all of those things, wherever else you get your podcast, do those things, rate and review. I don't think people realize that reviews actually really, really, really do good work. Even if it's a short review, you don't have to say a lot. But getting a review, getting a rating actually helps the algorithms suggest our podcast to others. That's a really great way to support what we're doing. All right. So guys, thank you so much. We went over time on our efforts, but I think it was a really good conversation, and we will definitely do this again.
Sounds great, man. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you liked today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.
Hello everyone, it's Doug from the Libertarian Christian Podcast. You might notice already that this recording sounds quite a bit different from usual. In fact, it probably sounds pretty crappy. Well, I'm doing this to show you something pretty amazing. As you might know, the guys over at Podsworth Media have been producing my show for several years, quite a while, hundreds of episodes. And now they have a brand new online app for taking rough recordings like this one and making them sound a whole lot cleaner and a lot more listenable in just a few easy clicks. So here are some of the core features. They remove background noise. It reduces plosives, which is really handy for me because I often forget to put my pop filter on before I do a YouTube video. Because pop filters look terrible when you're on camera. It fixes clipping. It removes clicks and pops. It evenly levels dialogue so that you don't have somebody talking really quietly. And then somebody talking really loud because they're too close to the mic or too far away from the mic. How do you use it? It's easy. You go to podsworth.com, you click get started, and because you're a listener to one of the Libertarian Christian Institute's podcasts, you can get 50% off your first order by entering the promo code LCI50. That's LCI50. And you will get 50% off your first order. If you are doing anything like a podcast, a video, a sermon, an audiobook, anything that's spoken word, you want to use podsworth.com and clean up your audio to be even more professional and polished.